Hello friends, this is a recording of Between the Lines Conversations on the Art of Writing, an event held at the SMSA. In celebration of World Day of the Writer, we were joined by a selection of fantastic authors, Tim Ayliff, Ashley Callaghan-Blunt, Shankari Chandran, and Ryan Butter. Led by Ryan, the panel shared their experiences as published authors, laughter at writing myths, and discussed creative techniques and methods. Whether you're a budding author, book lover, or passionate about creative process, get your pens at the ready because this event is filled with pearls of wisdom. This recording was made in the Henry Carmichael Theatre at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts, located on Gadigal land.
Thanks very much, Tom, for a generous introduction. Introduced by Tom Keneally, I think that's as good as it's going to get. Very happy to be here. Thanks everybody for coming and forming today and making the time. We're going to delve into the writing process with these fabulous authors. Before we start, I just want to share a piece of writing advice that's stuck in my mind from a while ago, and it's probably more relevant lately when thinking about it. And that's from Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Big Magic, about creativity and writing. And in that she says, to write or to create anything, you must hold two opposing thoughts in your mind. The first, that what you're doing is the most important thing that you can be doing. Because if you don't think that, you'll never find the drive or the commitment to complete it. You'll find something else and off you go. And the second thing you have to hold in your mind is that what you're doing is completely useless. And if you don't hold that thought, you become too attached to the work. You never let it go. You never finish it. And with what's going on in the world at the moment, I think as creatives, when you think of what's going on in the Ukraine, in Palestine, lives extinguished, stories will never get told, people will never tell their stories, it's very easy to think that what we're doing is useless. It's much harder to hold in your mind that what we're doing is important, that it could have any importance at all. How could it when you compare with events that are going around the world? But I think through history, you'll find that in the darkest times, that's when stories come forth, their connection, their resistance, their embryo of hope and memory. Even when there seems to be no hope or no chance of hope. So I think as writers and as readers, we all have a duty to not look away, to bear witness, to keep going, to write, and speak even in difficult times. And so we gather here today to talk about the trivial and the useless, but also the very important. But we do so acknowledging that there's a lot of pain and suffering in the world at the moment. So I want to start off with that. We've got some great questions, hopefully, to get you talking about the process and how you approach the writing. I'm going to start with Ashley. Ideas. They're everywhere. They're floating around. We're picking up all the time as writers. But writing a book's like a relationship. You're going to spend the next 2 to 3 years thinking about this book, thinking about these characters. And the book comes out, you spend another year talking about them at events like this. So my question to you is, how do you decide on the one idea? Which idea is going to become the book? Is there a process that? Is it organic? Are you fleshing out ideas?
Oh, it's just like dating. It's like the idea that, you know, there's all these potential candidates, right? But it's the idea that you just can't stop thinking about. It's the idea that is telling you it wants all your attention. So, for example, my first book was about my family's survival of the Armenian Genocide and its ongoing denial and its historical connections to Australia. I'm originally from Canada, but I moved to Australia when I was writing that book. And, you know, I spent 10 years researching and writing that book. Like, from the point I decided this is the idea I'm going to pursue to the point that it was published was nearly 10 full years. And I'm so glad I did that because I have such a deep and intimate understanding of that history, of the geopolitics that lead to denial, and of what is happening right now. Because right now, today, there are Azeri soldiers in Armenian territory. That genocide is not done. That genocide is still happening 100 years later. Armenia, like, unless something dramatic happens, Armenia will be wiped out. So in terms of, as well, what you're saying about the trivial and the important, like, I think there's just so much importance in what writers do. And it's, you know, even in my psychological thriller Dark Mode, like, It's a thriller. It's for crime lovers. You know, I wrote it for crime lovers. I'm a crime lover myself in terms of my reading habits. But I also worked in there things that are urgent, things that are happening. And so many people have come up to me and said, you know, I had no idea this was going on in the world. You know, in our homes, in our families, in our computers. And I'm so glad I know about it now.
Just a quick follow up. Is there any point in the idea in curation tension between what you want to write and what will sell in Australia or in Canada?
Oh, yeah. So that 10 years that I spent working on that first book, when I got it to the point where, you know, it was being shortlisted for unpublished manuscript awards, and publishers were requesting to read it, which is a huge step, you know, for a writer to have publishers actually pay attention to what you're doing and read your full manuscript and get back to you, you know, reply to your emails. What came back to me was like, oh, you know, this is really interesting material, really well written, but we can't sell a book about Armenia in Australia. No one cares. And partly why that the first book I ended up getting published, so that original book I wrote, still unpublished, but I had spent so long working on this topic, and I was like, how do I hook Australians into this book? And then I started researching, and some of you might remember, the assassination of the Turkish consul general and his bodyguard in Dover Heights in December 1980, a crime that is still unsolved today, a crime that is still $1 million reward out. If you have information about it, you can cash in. So I started the book with that, and that's how it ended up getting published. But it's no coincidence that the next book I wrote is called How to Be Australian, because I felt like, well, if you can't sell a book about Armenia in Australia, certainly you can sell a book about Australia in Australia.
So I'm going to riff off what Ashley's just said. Firstly, my dating life was never like yours. There were not multiple candidates, can I just say. Secondly, thank you for that beautiful introduction, right? Because it was very special, and it was very reflective, and I think we all really appreciated the way that you have framed today. My first novel, Song of the Sun God, had the same struggles as you. And so it's three generations of Sri Lankan Tamil Australian women, and it's about colonization, dispossession, war, forced migration, about all these things that I would think of as an Australian story. There are many Australian stories, and quintessentially Australian, and yet was told that it would not sell in Australia, that you couldn't sell a book about Australian Sri Lankan Tamils in Australia to the Australian market. And that was so devastating for me, and so repudiating for me in terms of my place in this country. I've been here since I was 3, and I'm now 50, so 47 years in this country, I feel I am Australian. And so with my next novel, I had actually finished my next novel, which was a thriller, The Barrier Set in This Dystopic Future. And I went through the novel and I just went control all, find all, replace all. And I changed my character from being a brown protagonist to being a white protagonist. And it found a publisher in Australia very quickly, and it opened the door. And actually with every novel that I've ever written or every piece of writing that I've ever done, I feel like at the end of that piece, I whisper into that book's ear and I say, please be the one that brings Song of the Sun God back to Australia, because this is my home and this is where I wanted that first novel to be published. And it was only after I had published my third novel, Chaitanya at Cinnamon Gardens, a novel which critiques what it means to be Australian and who gets to decide. It was a novel about race and racism in Australia, because, and by the time I wrote it, I figured my publishing career was over, so I just wrote it for myself. It was only with that novel brought Song of the Sun God home, to my home.
And I hope that when you won the one of Miles Franklin, you sent news of that to the people who rejected some of it.
Yeah, I think they just have to read about it in the paper. Yeah. I'm not Charlie Shaw.
Love it. Writers love revenge. All writers, not just the thrillers, but crime writers. Tim, I've got a different question for you. Before we came down here, we were in the library, Tom Keeler's library, and I went to the John le Carré book, had a little red dot on it, open it up to see what Tom had to say about John le Carré. And one of his comments was that he enjoyed the very pacey sentences. And you're obviously writing in the same genre, spy thriller. And what I noticed about your latest book is the extreme pace, like it just flew through it, reading. And I want to ask you, this is a real process, but how do you get that pace into the text? And is it something in the planning, in the structure? Are you thinking at a sentence level? Or does it come later when you're editing?
It comes... Is it Michael? No. Oh, yeah. It comes in two waves, really. It's on and off.
Yeah.
No, I'll just... Okay, I'll try.
Or a little bit higher up.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's off.
Okay,
right.
So just...
Can you hear me? I'm doing it. Yeah, you can hear me. Oh. So... Sounds like it's back on now. Anyway, always the way. So look, my books, I guess to give you an overview, I always think of my books that I have an overarching premise is that everything either has happened, will happen, or could happen. So I'm reaching into like real life stories, and you know, my day job, so 25 years I was a journalist, 17 years the ABC and other places around the world. And so for me, I was lucky in the roles that I played and worked in that I was involved in a lot of discussions that you'll never hear about. Really interesting stories, that details of which we can only share some. Because with journalism, there's really important elements that you need to get right, and you need to be able to prove. It's the factual basis of, you know, non-fiction. With fiction, you get to have a bit of fun with that. And so for me, when I sit down to write a book, I usually have the overarching premise. So I'll say my first book was Australia caught in the power struggle between the US and China. And that idea came from a conversation. I was in America on a US State Department scholarship. I was there for 3 weeks. It was during Obama's re-election campaign. It was about 6 weeks from the election. I was really lucky to be there. I was traveling around. I had meetings in State Department, White House. I went to the Democrat convention in Charlotte, met Rahm Emanuel and really interesting people. And I wasn't allowed to report on any of it. But in the State Department, I had this meeting where I'm asking lots and lots of questions. And then at the end of it, they said, oh, cool, we've got a few questions for you. And I said, oh, well, you know, I'm just a journalist, you know, from the ABC. Back then, I was the executive producer of News Breakfast. I said, I think you might know a bit more about the world than me, but I'll give it a go. And the question they asked me was, could I ever imagine a day when Australia would turn its back on the US in favour of a closer relationship with China? So I guess my answer to that question is not so relevant here, but the fact that the question was being posed was really interesting to me. So that's that book. And in each of my books, I chip off a big, you know, bubbling, simmering issue. So then going back to the question around pace, I've learned a lot in this writing process. So I've just finished my fifth book, actually the copy edit this morning, about 3 hours ago. So, so that was a big, you know, joy. So that's coming out in July. And with each book, you know, I'm chipping off a big issue. But the difficult lessons I've learned, like my third book, I wrote twice. And that was really tough lessons in that book for me, in that the plot, I'll say it the way I think it's so... I hope it makes sense to you, but the plot wasn't working hard enough for the reader. So whenever I sit down to write a chapter of a book now, the chapter, I say, how is that chapter advancing the plot? And that can be through character or through the actual story itself. If I can't answer that question, delete. So I'm really brutal with that. And also, I want readers to turn pages fast. I want them to really enjoy the story. I want them to understand an issue that I've decided to have a crack at with the plot. So I try to write in a really, I guess, engaging way, dialogue heavy often as well. So short, sharp sentences, really, you know, short, sharp, blunt, sometimes discussions, conversations. So I'm just thinking about the reader constantly, and that's why I write in that, you know, that pacey sort of thriller style. And I've learned that from reading great writers. Michael Connelly comes to mind. You know, I grew up reading Macario. So yeah, I like learning from people, and I'm really hard on myself as I write.
I'm terrified that you've got another book coming out, because I saw your big box of books coming in. It's a small market. Would you like to make a comment, or?
Oh, I mean, pace is fascinating, because it's like issues are not plot, right? And so you want to have those issues, you want to engage with them, but they are not plot. And for me, going from writing memoir, which traditionally isn't a genre where you have to worry so much about pace, obviously it's still a factor, but then going into thriller writing, like, I wanted to write a book, like, the thrillers that I love the most, you know, like Candace Fox and J.P. Pomeroy, Tana French, they're books that, like, I start chapter one and I absolutely cannot put them down. Like, I just find myself reading them when I'm supposed to be doing something else. And I really wanted to give that to readers. So, like, I spent so much time, you know, figuring out, like, what is the actual engine of pace. And I use a spreadsheet to, like, work out a lot of things. And, like, the behind-the-scenes technical stuff is actually really boring. But it reveals how you can move a reader through a book.
Just to add to that, first of all, there are a lot of your books over there, but if everybody bought 10, Christmas is coming eventually. That would be a really, maybe an excellent gift. Secondly, I think, this part of this conversation is about writing, and you've asked about publishing. I think about our journeys to publication. So my second book was a thriller, and my agent, I remember her looking at it and saying, look, I just don't know what to do with you because you've written a literary fiction novel and now you've written a thriller.
How dare you?
She said, you can only do that. And I love my agent and my agent loves me and she has stuck with me through a decade of not much happening in my literary career. Okay, so when I speak to you frankly, please know it's with love and respect for my agent. But she made me cry in IKEA. I was crying into my meatballs as she says to me, booksellers will just not know where to put you on a shelf. You have to think about your brand. And so, are you a literary fiction writer or are you a thriller writer? And I was like, but Le Carre's thrillers are literary fiction.
Absolutely.
They are stunning works of literary fiction. And like you, he takes a stab at a big issue and then executes it beautifully on everything, character, plot, language, pace, he nails it. As does Tim, 10 copies each, please. So, you know,
why are we selling Tim's books?
There's so many, and I feel
sorry. She won the ball. She won the ball, Franklin. Listen to a book.
So, I think in terms of, you know, who are we as writers and pace and plot and so on, just for those of you that are making the journey towards publication, something to think about is apparently brand, but something to think about also is what is the story, that overarching problem that you want to solve? What is it that you want to spend 3 to 5 years with or 10 years with and have that relationship with that you love enough or are angered by enough to give it 100,000 words and then to rewrite 30,000 of them, like to delete 30,000 or all of them and write some more?
I'm always surprised that booksellers don't know where to put the books. I've heard that a lot, but where would the bookseller put it in the shop?
Oh, my first book was half fiction, half non-fiction. That was, they were just like...
That blows their mind.
Yeah, and I have a double grad surname without a hyphen, so I'm just basically impossible.
You are in trouble.
I know.
It is difficult. I do have a lot of sympathy for booksellers. There are a lot of us, and they're trying to work all that out. But I also think that readers are smarter than that.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think in the marketing of the book, yes, you need to say kind of what this is, but it doesn't need to be one or the other. And your point about Le Carre is a really good one. It used to drive a lot of, you know, Val McDermott's spoken very publicly about how crime novels become put in this other basket of like, hang on a second, why can't a crime novel win the Booker? Or, you know, or the Miles Franklin for that matter. And you know, it's very frustrating as a writer where you get put in the box. I mean, I'm writing a series, but I'm writing a standalone at the moment, and I'm having a discussion with my agent, something similar. Have you thought about writing that under a different name? And I went, why would I do that? I have a name. And just because it's not a John Bailey book, I think people are going to know, you know.
Please tell me this is the same book that we copied in this morning.
No.
That's right, he's prolific, okay. Just in case you wanted to.
Let's.
I should write another little Peele's name. Seems to lend you his name.
I'm not sure.
I'm going to come to you now, Shankar. I'm going to go back to process, back to the very detail. Chai Tai Cinnamon Gardens is rich, vivid, detailed scenes. I'm still thinking about jasmine-scented vine climbing up a wall, and I don't know why, but you've got this amazing capacity to build a scene. I want to get into the space between your fingertips and the keyboard, that little moment before you hit the keyboard where it goes from something in your mind to words on the page when you're writing those scenes. What's that? What's going on in your mind? Are you observing a scene and you're writing what you're seeing? Or are you actually in the characters, in the scene, looking out, feeling, living what they're...
Yeah.
Just what's that process of writing such a detailed scene? And again, sort of what I asked him is, how much did that just come out as a natural gift in the first draft, or you're coming back to flesh out scenes later on in the editing?
Mm.
Please say it's in the editing.
Yeah. Actually, it's, you know, it's first draft is great. It's perfect. I landed it on the first draft. You want to land it, Tom? I land it on the first draft. Actually, I don't at all, and it is hard graft for me. I am hard graft, and so grateful, actually, just aside for my parents, who are hardworking people and only ever modeled hard work. The moment before I hit the keyboard, I will have an overarching theme like you. I'll have something that a problem that I want to solve, an issue that I want to explore, and it's usually something that makes me really angry. So, you know, for such a small, sweet looking girl, I'm very angry. And I'm trying to work through rage over some kind of injustice. And the writing process helps me move from rage to love. I'm not going to tell you this because I feel comfortable saying it, because Christos Tronkos said it to me recently. Therefore, I now feel I have permission to say it myself. Before he goes onto a panel, he said he prays a little. And before I start writing a novel, I am a Hindu, and I just center my mind with a particular, it's the most powerful prayer in Hinduism, and it helps me just to remember that I'm not doing this, it's not about myself, it's not for myself. I'm having a conversation with the page, and the words will come, the story will come, and I try to just leave me out of it. And then for me, the best writing for me, Ryan, is when I'm literally not making shit up, but when I am just writing it down. So when I can see the world in my mind, and I'm writing literally what I'm seeing in my mind. And it's a tremendous experience, right? Because you suddenly sort of...
So you're watching the characters interact in the same place.
Exactly. And because I don't have a huge amount of time to write, Friday is a big day for me. It's a very important day. It's my writing day. And Friday is sacred for me. I won't even take phone calls from my parents on a Friday. And on the Thursday night, before I go to bed, I will say to my characters, what are you going to do tomorrow? So I'm asking them to tell me what they're going to do tomorrow and to show me what they're going to do tomorrow, so that when I go back into my world on Friday, I'm just writing down what I see. And to get to the Friday in a way where my mind is primed for that world, I would have done four sprints. So four times during the week, at some point, I'd try to give myself 20 minutes, and I'll say, Sean, it's just like 100 words. That's all it is. It just has to be 100 words, no pressure. And it will often be more than 100 words, but if I tell myself it's just 100 words, I can do it. 20 minutes, go into my world, and just keep my mind ticking over, because those other sort of 6 days of the week are obviously laundry and corporate sustainability and all the other things that people have to do.
Yeah. Mm. How long do you give yourself on the Friday?
I write, wake up early, and I try to write for the entire day. I try to pretend to pay attention to my children on the Friday afternoon, and then I get back to the writing in the evening. So I don't know how many hours it is, but I really try to max out Friday.
Well, that Hindu prayer is working. What are the rules of conversion?
We are actually accepting of all faiths. So, despite what Narendra Modi says, we are accepting of all faiths.
Do you want to make a... What, Tim?
Oh,
do you want to say on that, or how you approach things?
Oh, yeah,
or?
My writing process is now just changed, only because I've been writing while having a busy day job, you know, like you do. And so for me, for many, many years, it was... Well, the first book was fitted in wherever I could, so that was late at night, really, sometimes a little bit in the morning, and then never on weekends, because I had very small children at the time. But once my first book, I signed a three-book deal on that, and I knew that then I had to go figure out, how am I going to do this without getting divorced? So I then eventually settled on writing on weekends only, and
to be fair to the ABC, that was, you know, gave me huge opportunities for many years. I had a really busy day job there. So I was the managing editor of TV News, so I oversaw a news channel and a lot of TV news programs. So for me, up really early, you know, getting into the day's news, so that when I got to work, I would need to know everything that we're going to be considering as covering stories and have proper discussions in meetings. So it became all about weekends for me with the books. So I get up at 5, 5:30, Saturday and Sunday. Sometimes I get up even earlier, occasionally like 4, 4:30. And I'd write for whatever I could get away with before kids' sport and things started taking over. And I wanted to, it was really enjoyable, and still is, but really enjoyable time for me to be able to do that on the weekends. It's a nice escape from the real busy, you know, day job. My phone didn't stop ringing from work, by the way. I still have to get calls on weekends. But that time was really great. I loved it. I'd escape into that world. My characters, in the way you were describing your characters earlier, they're all very real to me, because I'm writing a series of being with these characters for 5 books now. So if something bad happens to them, sometimes I get a little bit upset, and it's me doing it to them, but in a way, you know. So for me, that was that sort of time in the morning between 3 and 5 hours I would write on Saturday and Sunday, and I could almost write a book a year in doing that every weekend. But every weekend I do it, and now that I've stopped working at the ABC and I'm working on the books and this TV series that we're in development on the books as well. I'm actually still in a 7-day work pattern, so I'm getting in trouble for that at the moment. So I'm, you know, trying to slow down on Sundays, but I just enjoy it. So I love it, you know. And first and foremost, as writers, you're really interested to hear what you all think about this, but we love what we do. I've got two and a half books in a drawer that no one will ever see because they're crap. But I love writing them. And
only
I
two and a half. I've got about 10.
Yeah.
So I just started.
And it's so common. Every writer would have that story, you know, even the big global megastars. But we love it. That's why we do it.
Yeah.
And it's just in there, and it needs to come out.
Right? I think that's the thing, Tim. People talk about being passionate about this, or my husband's passionate about football, possibly religious about football. We are obsessed with writing, and I don't know how not to write. It is an obsession, and once I start a story, and this is why I try to do my taxes before I sit down to write a story, otherwise, you know, I'm going to get a call. I can't do other things very well. I am so monofocal because I am obsessed by it, and it will not let go until I've got to where I think it needs to be.
Incredible discipline,
by the way.
Come on,
Shaka,
we're all there for the money.
Actually, one quick anecdote just before you said, sorry. But what
I do
we
have
to talk about there. Yeah, no, is Michael Robotham, who you would all know, is a brilliant writer. He tells this story, and I'll tell it very quickly because it's really relevant to what we're talking about. He's sitting at, when he created his new series, which the fourth book, I think it's the fourth, is coming out in July. Unfortunately, the same time as my book, but anyway. But it's a brilliant, really sort of twisty female character. And I remember him, he was telling me, he's sitting at dinner with his wife, and she just looks at him and she goes, "You're with her now, aren't you?"
So great.
Yeah, sorry, it happens. I'm going to push it along.
Oh, sorry.
Do the
next question. This question's for you, Ashley. Today's about sharing insights and process. I'll share a secret with you. I write nonfiction, and I can guarantee you that every nonfiction writer, and you've written nonfiction actually, every nonfiction writer at some point when they're driving from one archive to the other in Australia, or one museum, one gallery, when they've spent more money on research materials than they're ever going to make selling the book, at some point every nonfiction writer promises themselves the next book will be fiction. I'm just going to sit at home and make it all up. They all think that. But of course the reality is that if you want your fiction, your invention to work, it has to be accurate or no one will believe the invention. Now, your latest book, I can only imagine the amount of research that went in. And I'm thinking like the first couple of pages, dead bodies, there's plants, there's what's going on online. How do you manage that research? And then how do you incorporate it into the fiction without it coming across as didactic, or without the reader seeing the research? If I want the research, I'll go to the NBC or whatever, you know, but I want to be fiction, I want to be taken away. How do you blend that?
Yeah, I loved all the research that I did for Dark Mode. So Dark Mode is about, it's set here in Sydney, sweltering hot summer. The main character runs a garden center, a little tiny neighborhood garden center in Annandale. And so she is someone who knows all about plants, right? And she's also someone who, for very good reasons, has a lot of trust issues with people in her life. So she finds her relationship with plants is a lot easier because, you know, plants, you give them the right amount of sunshine and the right soil conditions, and they'll grow, and she's excellent at that. People are much more complicated. So one of the things that I did was, I was just, you know how you're on the internet and you just come across something like just bizarre? I found this fact that grass, when it is cut with a mower, screams. And at first I was like, this seems made up. This seems like something someone put on the internet that is absolutely not true. But I did a little more digging into it because I couldn't stop thinking about it. And it turns out, no, this is a scientific fact. There are scientific research papers on this phenomenon. Plants, it's not just grass, plants let out a sound, but it's just at such a high Hertz level, we can't hear it, but scientific instruments can pick it up. And so scientists have described this as the plant screaming, because they do it when they're being cut with a mower or when they're in desperate need of water. And so I started thinking about, like, you know, in the bushfire summer, walking around in the drought, and thinking about this idea that all the plants around us were screaming for water, and just the atmosphere that that creates. And I thought, oh, I've got to have a character who knows about plants. And then I started researching just like all the bizarre facts about plants. And this is one of the things I love about being a writer, is it's just an excuse to spend time looking up weird things on the internet. So I found out all these strange things about plants. Like, there's this whole family of corpse flowers that give off the smell of rotting meat. And again, to me, that was just like the perfect detail for a crime novel. So my main character, she's out for her morning run, you know, it's super hot, January, Sydney, out very, very early, and she comes across this woman right near her home who has clearly been murdered, also happens to look exactly like her, and one of her first thoughts is that the smell is exactly like a voodoo lily, which is one of these types of corpse flowers. So I think for me, a lot of that research was just organically incorporating it into the story. So it's not there as an informative tidbit. It is actually part of what is happening for the characters and for the plot.
Tim, for you as well, because you're, like, as you said, it could have happened, might happen, will happen. How are you managing that integration of the material? Research.
Yeah,
if you are doing research, hopefully you're doing something.
Yeah, no, I do a lot of research. So usually I'm reading somewhere between 5 and 10 non-fiction books, I imagine, for each thriller that I'm writing, or kind of big essays. But a lot of books, like, for instance, on Russia for Killer Trader Spy, I would have read probably 7 books, I reckon. But also speeches. So every year that the Director General of ASIO, Mike Burgess, at the moment, you would have seen some headlines, you know, in the last few days. So he usually gives me some good fodder, I gotta say.
The next one, a politician that's been turned?
No, well, I actually put a quote from him at the front of Killer Trader Spy, because he gave this speech where he said there are more foreign agents or their proxies operating in Australia than at any time since the height of the Cold War. And I thought, ooh, okay. Let's see what the Russians are up to. Of course, he's talking a lot about China with that. A year later, after giving that speech, he then upped the ante on that quote and said that he described it as a thriller fiction. It's a clear and present danger. So he went straight to Hollywood with his quote. But for me, I mean, that is where a lot of my ideas come from, is diving into that sort of detail, but also some things that happen. So my third book, The Enemy Within, I write about white supremacists and far-right nationalists, and I have another strand to that plot, which is around abuse of power. And you may all remember when the AFP was raiding a lot of journalists about 5 or 6 years ago, and one of the places they raided was the ABC. And so the AFP
were after a the source of a story that two great journalists, Sam Clark and Dan Oakes, had written about alleged human rights abuses by Australian soldiers in Afghanistan, of which we now know is true, right? So they had good sources, we'd done those stories. So they came into the ABC that day with a warrant that had been signed off by a district court judge from Nowra that gave them the power to alter, change, copy or delete the ABC's files in the course of their search investigation. So alter, change, copy or delete. So I've got the warrant, I quote directly from that warrant in my novel, because I thought, what if that power got in the wrong hands? And I'm not for a second saying there are bad eggs within the AFP that might do that, but the fact that that power existed, the fact that it got signed off by a district court judge as well, made me think, okay, there's something a little bit wrong here.
Is Nowra Al Langley?
Yeah, maybe.
And you know, I'm not far from Nowra.
You know, on Sense of Place, I've got a funny story, Sense of Place, it was so great listening to you talk about plants and all that, although I've murdered quite a few plants in my time.
I need to talk about
you say it's easy to keep people alive, but I'm not sure of that. But I was in Germany for work, and after it, I wanted to go to a place called St. Malo in France. I'm not sure if you know much about that. So it's this beautiful old, like, Roman, you know, town on the edge of the English Channel, directly across from Portsmouth. And I was thinking about this book and what I might, I wanted to say a bit of it there. So I negotiated with my wife, was very supportive, that I would just take an extra, you know, a few days at the end of my work trip just to go there. And I did, and it's incredible. Like St. Malo, the tides, so the water rises by 11 metres a day, up and down, because the water pushes through the channel. And it's incredible to watch it. You're just watching the water come towards you. So it's incredible. And then go out again, of course. So I got home, wrote the book. My publisher said, I'm not quite sure about this one. And that's the book that I rewrote. And I rewrote it and brought it home to Australia. So I didn't even use the Somalo stuff, which was a bit controversial with my wife. However, I've set a chapter in Somalo in Killatrae's Spine. It works perfectly. So the tax office is listening, that part, production works. And my wife is finally happy that I was able to justify the trip.
Fantastic.
Good work.
I'm just conscious of the time. I'm going to finish off. I want to give a chance for people to ask questions at the end. But I want to finish off with two questions for everyone, so you know, for the same question. But I'll throw it to you first, Shankri, because one of the things that really amazed me when I started publishing commercially, actually, is anyone from Affirm Press here? No? Great. Publishing is absolutely bonkers. Like, no one will tell you that. It's absolutely bonkers. The book's out, whether it's your first book or your latest book. It's great. Book's out, publisher's going to take care of the marketing, and you start writing your new book, right? Wrong. Can you describe that relationship once the book is out in the world? What your role is as the author, what the publisher's role is? I think that's something that's so misunderstood in Australian writing or prose. How does that work? What's that dynamic like?
Yeah, so I'm just going to comment on one thing that you said, which is that I think the writers that I love the most are the ones who are noticing everything. I think the greatest skill of a writer is not necessarily to have some game with words, but to be observant and attentive. And you sound like a very attentive person, and it's so important to see and then to write.
Sorry, before you start, Chatham House rules.
Yeah, okay, on publishers?
Yeah,
got it.
And open microphones.
Yeah.
Recording, so I'm just saying.
Says a thriller, not right.
It's being recorded, just in case.
Yeah. And this is off the record. So I thought I'd just send off the book and we'd be done and I could move on to my next novel. Yeah, it's so worth laughing about, isn't it? So then you have to be your own markers in person. And what every writer, all writers want to do is write, right? I want to get back into my pajamas and just write. But we are instead, we have to now create a social media identity. We have to talk to people. We're here. We're, that all of us would rather be writing. And this is the one thing.
I don't write like you. I'd prefer to be here.
What's the thing? The only thing that writers want to do when they're not writing is actually talk about books.
Yeah.
We either want to read books, we want to write books, or we want to talk about books.
True.
And that's how you get us here, because we love to talk about books. And I really wanted to meet Tom Keneally. So I think we are expected to be our own marketing agents or our own marketing team. And
to be clear, that's economic input from you to get to the events, to market the book.
It actually depends, right? So it really depends. And I now try to push hard back on the publisher to say to whoever wants me to be somewhere, because for the most part, they are actually paying for you to get there. But there's times when, for example, a taxi fare, this is going to sound really pedantic, but an Uber from A to B, if I've got four children and a day job, and I've got to go from, you know, from a festival in Perth to a meeting in Sydney for my corporate job, and I need some help, and actually, it's not always covered, and so you actually economically have to be prepared to assert yourself. And I think this is the main point, which is that when we begin our writing journey, and I think for many years into our writing journey and our publishing journey, is that we feel very disempowered. We feel like we have no power. The publisher is God, the marketing team and sales team and the acquisitions meetings are God, and we are at sea in all of that, because really the only thing we know how to do is write. And so then you have to learn how to do all these other things and learn how to assert yourself. So it's, I think it's a really challenging industry, and I strongly advise all my children against it.
Yeah. The other thing you learn to do is to see the world in $3 slices, because that's the royalty. So if you catch a taxi and it's $40, you know, that's 13 books I've got to sell.
Yeah.
That'd be worth it where I'm going.
So true.
Yeah. Oh, Ashley?
Yeah, Cash.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I think a lot of writers are more introverted, and I think I'm very lucky that I am more extroverted, so I just absolutely delight in meeting readers, talking to readers. That's been one of the great joys of particularly publishing a thriller. Actually, I loved publishing my memoir about Australia, because it's called How to Be Australian. You know, you think, oh, the market for that is visitors and people who just moved here, and yeah, they're going to get a lot out of it. The secret about that book is that I really wrote it for Australians to be like, this is what this country is like. And it's so wonderful when Australians read the book and they come up to me and they say, oh, I'm so surprised about how much I learned about Australia. I did not expect to learn this much about, you know, about my own country. And so that was really wonderful. But I published a thriller because, I love thrillers and talking to fellow thriller fans, you know, about the thrillers they love, the crime books they love, and why, has just been such a joy. So I feel really lucky to get to do that and to be part of that community. As much as I love writing, I think I love connecting with readers equally.
I learned something really interesting from Sarah Ayoub, a Lebanese Australian writer. She talked about narrative intimacy. I'd never heard that expression before, narrative intimacy. The relationship that you create with the reader when you write, and I think about that a lot, right? Because I think if you're picking up my book to read my book, then that's a privilege for me that you're reading my book, because you could pick up Tim's book or 10 copies of Tim's book or Ashley's book or Tom's book, and instead, on this particular moment, this particular day, you've picked up my book and spent your time, the most valuable thing you have, with my story. And so that is a privilege.
Yeah.
And the way that Sarah described it was narrative intimacy. And on those days when I buy a coffee for one book, $3, or, you know, half a coffee for one book, I think actually there is more to it than the economics, because the economics are not working. But there is more to it. There is the relationship. There is the beauty of the story and the fact that we can't not tell them.
Yeah, there's a real privilege to what we're doing. I mean, we're doing something we love and being able to connect and talk to readers. And our stories become your stories. So when you read a book, you're going to have a different interpretation of some things, or certainly different read than someone else might of that story. You take different things from it. You'll love characters that other people hate. And I love that, because then it's like when I finish a book and it's published, I'm lucky enough for it to be published, I hand it over and then it becomes someone else's in a way. And I'll connect with people on that, and I love having conversations with people about that. And then on the work that we do, I mean, these events are fun.
I mean, this is fun. I love being, you know, some Miles Franklin winner, no Ashton, Brian as well. You know, this is, it's a privilege to be out and about. But there is, as a writer these days, for those that are writers themselves or looking to get books published, it doesn't stop with when you publish the book. You actually do need to find ways to connect with readers, because that's a transaction. You know, they expect that from you as well. Not everyone, but they do. I think on social media, I'm a bit, you know, a coin toss on social media, that I think most of it's just sort of junk out there, and I don't know that a lot of the stuff that we put out really does much in terms of spreading the word.
You've been following me.
Yeah. Well, I do think there's a bit too much of an onus put on that sometimes, and too much pressure on writers to spend too much time on it, because the most important thing you can do, and some of the best advice I got really early on from, you know, some far more successful writers than me, was, I hope you're finding time to write. And the writer who said that to me sold millions and millions of books, but it was a subtle kind of, you know, I've probably seen a lot of the posts I've been doing out there, and he's saying, are you writing or are you posting? And I always remember that. And I thought,
but when you're selling millions and millions of books, you don't have to do that, because you're selling millions of books. Like, your publisher is paying probably hundreds of thousands of dollars to market your books. When you're a writer who's not getting that investment from your publisher, I think there is that sort of like, well, how else are people gonna hear? So there's kind of two sides of the same thing.
There are, and I agree with that.
Yeah.
I don't think it's one or the other. I do think though that it's
just
a reminder.
I just think it's easy for that writer to say that to you.
Yeah, but I didn't think he was having a go at me. I thought it was a good advice.
Yeah.
And for me, the most important thing, and I have this discussion with my publisher, I aim every single time I sit down, I need to write a better book than the last one.
Yeah.
That's my job.
Yeah.
I'm gonna hold it there. I would say just on that, like, I've done things in my life which have been a lot more profitable than writing. I've never done anything more rewarding. Like, it's been so rewarding to be a writer, to engage with people, to meet people. It's been brilliant. I want to leave time for questions. I'm going to do one last quick thing, because it's about tips here today. There's a lot of myths out there. So we're going to play a quick game of myth or tip. So I'm going to give you you tell me if it's a myth or a tip.
Do we have a buzzer to hit?
Well, maybe you might want to give a microphone to Tom. He might like to engage as well. I don't know if we can get a mic to...
Yeah.
He might like to play as well. We're just going to go through. All I need an answer is myth or tip.
Okay.
Are we ready?
It's like a fast game, right?
It's a fast game. First one, write what you know.
Yeah.
Tip.
Yeah, find out what you know by writing what you didn't think.
Oh, God. Myth or tip, Tom. Myth or tip. Number two, show, don't tell.
Myth.
Tip. We're not missing
tip.
Different genres.
Tip. Yeah, tip.
Definitely show, not tell.
To be a writer, you need to write every day.
Myth.
Aspiration.
I'll go with myth.
Now, just to get a book finished quicker, you've got to write every day.
I'm going to go over the rules of this. Four, every life event is source material.
Myth. You don't want to ruin next life.
I think it's tip, actually. My parents are so concerned, and I think it's tip.
I'll go with tip.
And myth or passion? I think the first, yes.
Perfect. Number five, writing cannot be taught, only learned.
Myth!
Myth.
Oh, writing cannot be taught,
only
can
learned.
Can you teach writing? Can writing be taught? Writing can be taught.
We're going to move on. Myth. Tom? From Tim to Tom.
Fast game, right?
It's tip, I think, because it's true that you can only learn to write books by writing them. I think things can be taught, like how to go on. You know, a kid who writes something brilliant, and you say, I'm afraid, bad news, kid. You're stuck. The fairy godmother stopped at your cradle and cursed you with the writing curse.
I think that's a tip. Sit, character trumps plot.
Myth.
Ooh, character trumps plot.
Myth.
So tip.
Character trumps plot. Myth.
Myth. Okay, so thriller
myth.
Writer.
Easy. Thank you, Tom.
So plot. So you're saying plot is more important.
No, I said character trumps plot. So yeah, so it's, plot's more important than character.
Plot more important? Plot?
Plot.
Plot? Plot?
Character drives plot, so yeah.
Character.
Character drives
character.
Plot.
Tom and I agree.
Me too.
Just saying.
Plot.
Can I be on the fence on that?
No take back.
That's not how you worded it, though. That's not how you worded it.
Character trumps plot.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
said trumps.
You said
not
trumps.
Drives. Drives is different. I would agree character drives plot, but not trumps plot.
But if it... Okay, I'm not going to argue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your words matter.
Yeah.
You're talking to people that really
yeah.
care about words.
Okay, last one. Ignore all writing advice.
Myth.
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 Sorry.
Myth.
Myth.
Unless it's from John Le Carre.
Yeah.
He might be giving any more advice, Tom. Brilliant. Thank you so much. That's so engaging. Just very generous with your knowledge, and I think it's given us really great insight into your process and how you're writing, and hopefully we've been able to touch on some subjects that we don't usually get at the festivals. I'm going to open it up to questions from the floor. I think I might have a microphone. Do we give any questions?
I've got one here.
Don't be shy.
All right, I'll ask a question. No one else asks a question, I will. Two more long at Sydney University. Non-fiction. We spoke about thrillers, about history, about personal experiences. I'm writing a science book, a textbook. How do I write it in such a way that it's one of those things that students will find page turners and they can't put
it? Storytelling. Storytelling. Bring your storytelling aspects to your science. Because science still is stories, right?
Well, but it's as dry as dust.
That's your challenge.
If you think it's dry as dust, the reader will think it's dry as dust. So you need to crack that challenge.
So
how do you make dust on dry?
What do I wind up? How do I wind that up?
I think what Ashley said, you've got to find the story in it. You've got to find the narrative in it that's going to drive it through, make it interesting. Why did you engage with it? Why are they going to engage with it? I think you need to find that.
And who are the characters that drive this great plot that you've come up with?
There's some great scientists out there.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think human, connect on that human level. Science is a human.
Yeah.
Connect through the humans.
Can I just say, find some Asperger's people.
Ah.
The story, you know, and the science and the...
Charlotte. Yeah. That's actually, that's a super interesting character, you know. Do you hear what I mean? Asperger's person.
Yeah. Hi, so I'm from Germany, studying German and English. This is why I'm here. And the big thing, of course, in English is studying all about literature. And like all day through, I'm taught that all of your thoughts and all of your words have so deep and mindful thoughts behind it. Do you really have that? Like, do you sit there? Sit there while writing and be like, okay, the reader is kind of thinking this or that, or maybe understand it in my way, or what are your thoughts behind writing? Do you really have deep thoughts, or do you just want to put the story out, maybe?
I'll plagiarizing up with the stories writing history, so I'll let Sean think that doesn't answer that.
So for my first draft of anything that I'm writing, if I am thinking about the reader or how it will be received, it will go wrong. It will go awry. For my first draft, I am just thinking about the story. And I am trying, and I write without looking back. So I do what Stephen King says, which is to put super glue on your bum and just write. And so the words that I use are almost quite aggressive, right? I think I'm going to smash out a first draft. That's because I used to be an M&A lawyer. So I'm just thinking about what is the story that's happening in my mind and how can I just get words on a page. And then I go back and I will edit and edit and edit. And at some point in that, I will be thinking, for example, with Chai Time at Cinnamon Gardens, which was potentially a very controversial and alienating book. The thought that I had within that novel in subsequent drafts was, if I wanted to have a conversation with the reader, not someone that agrees with me or knows me or, you know, not someone in my echo chamber, about what it means to be Australian and what it's like to be Australian when you don't look like Ryan, right? How would I have that conversation with you in a loving and respectful manner so that you will listen to me? So that's when the thoughts of the reader come into it.
Just a very quick question, the mystery role of the editor. Could you give us an insight of the role of the editor?
I just got my structural edit back, which is the big sort of big picture edit before you get to the more line by line edit. That's called the copy edit. So I just got my structural edit back and it's totally overwhelming. The editor comes in and they've got all kinds of ideas about, like, they're thinking about how are we going to sell this book? What is currently selling? What is working? What did we think was going to sell but completely flopped? We don't want that to happen. So, but they're also looking at your story and thinking, how can we make this the best possible version of itself? Like, they're trying to figure out, what have you tried to do here? And where is it working and where is it not pulling it off? And this is one of the things about writing is the story is 100% in my head. When I write a scene, I can see the whole scene in crystal clear detail. So when I read back what I wrote, my brain is adding a lot of the things that I see, but that aren't necessarily on the page, right? Then someone else comes along and reads it, they can't see in my brain, they've only got the words on the page. So now what have I conveyed that's worked? And what have I totally missed? And so, like, my next book is set in Winnipeg, Canada, in a minus 40 degree winter. And it culminates in this big snowstorm right out in the snow. And my agents and my publisher, my editor, have said, we wanted to start in a snowstorm. I was like, it starts in the city. Like, they're indoors. It's warm. They're like, no. Start it in a snowstorm.
You know, just on that, and the interesting thing that I would say, can you start in a snowstorm? Your publishers and editors now, they're obsessed with how you start a book. You have a much shorter period of time to engage a reader than I think writers did 20 years ago, and that's because of television. There is so much amazing, you know, television we're watching now, that's what we're competing with. So that's actually changed a lot of styles of writing. And you're talking about the short, sharp, punchy, engaging plots. You know, I think that's something we think about as well.
I sat on a panel with an editing panel once, and an editor had a really good analogy. He said, when he gets a first draft from a writer, he feels like he's a building inspector rocking up in his high viz. He goes, and sometimes I need the bulldozer. Yeah. And then just to demolish it. And other times, like, oh, you're gonna leak here, or this isn't structurally sound, or so I think it depends. But as a writer, I love having my work edited. And I think if you've got it's really important to have a really trustful relationship that they're trying to make it as good as it can be. We're not Hemingway. I think Hemingway had a clause that not a single apostrophe was to be moved in his work. I will say, if you can make it better, knock yourself out.
Yeah, for sure.
I've got a quick question here, Ryan. Thanks very much for your efforts as well. I was interested to ask, it's sort of become a granular chat about the practices, but it started off with a sort of higher philosophical perspective about using a sort of a prayer, or also, Tim, maybe in your days in the ABC, seeing things from a sort of his life fair perspective. So I just wondered whether the granular hits the philosophical, and if those kinds of relationships are influencing what you produce, is there a sort of consciousness in all of these, as well as a practice? Or could you have one without the other?
I'm not sure. Questions like, could you have one without the other, always confuse me. So I'll answer the earlier part of your question. I do think that I am... I think, as I said before, I think I am actually trying, in my first novels, to solve something. So I am actually trying to unlock a moral question through the granular of words, plot, character, construction, editing. And that's how I write. But I don't think everybody writes like that or has to write like that. And at some point in my future, I would actually like to give myself the freedom to write contemporary romance or to write, you know, a zombie apocalypse. Because that would sound like a lot of fun. And it just happens to be that for me as a lawyer, as someone that has come to Australia as a first generation and has escaped a civil war, whose family has escaped a civil war, that for now, at the moment, my writing sits in that space of exploring things like dispossession, colonization, erasure, and the creation of community. But, you know, look forward to a contemporary romance from here. Watch the space.
I think one of the real strengths of fiction is that you can, I find, you can get much closer to the truth than you can in non-fiction. That's a somewhat controversial thing to say, but it's because you are unbound by a lot of the strictures of this has actually happened or this person didn't say that. Well, if you're really doing your research and trying to understand the world, and perspective is really important about that, so if you're writing about racism, that, you know, I'm a, you know, middle-aged white guy who probably needs to learn a little bit about what it's like to be not a middle-aged white guy to be able to make sure those perspectives are in a book when I'm writing about white supremacists, for instance. And being a middle-aged white guy doesn't preclude me from being able to accurately portray that, in my view. But I need to be super, super conscious of all of the readers and that perspective coming across. So on the philosophical, I guess, question, for me, I don't think all crime novelists are really wanting to say something about the world as it is now, but I think all the really good ones are, and they do it really well. So there's something about shining a light in dark places that readers find fascinating, but it's because I guess it helps them to either sleep well at night or recognise that, hey, there are these issues within the world that we can't ignore.
I'm just wondering, as a semi-dyslexic person, ADD, do you see any place for the use of voice program, you know, in terms of technologies that we've got now, and say, like on the phones, you know, we can use your voice program that you can connect up, that'll print out. I know that, you know, they're different processes in terms of brain function, but in terms of adding that in to the writing process.
So speaking it rather than sitting there typing it all right.
Yes.
Yeah. So we have a friend, Ashley and I have a friend who has a significant long-term illness, and she writes her first draft by speaking it. So she walks around the house, speaks into a device, I'm not sure what it is, and speaks her first novel, which is also, as she says, why there's a lot of dialogue in her novels in the first draft, and so on. And I think it's incredible how that has changed. And she's a brilliant writer. In fact, this is public information because she's done interviews about it. Ray Cairns, a thriller writer. Phenomenal writer, really great thriller writer, Crime with Heart, and she speaks it first.
Can I just thank all of you as well, the five of you, you know, the great tips.
I'll just add on that. I've tried that. I had a job where I drove sort of 6-7 hour stretches. It was awful. It was terrible. I was just talking to myself. But the other thing is, I've found like a really great editing tip is to read out loud what you've written. This, and it just shows what a difference is. As you said, like, sometimes you're writing things, you think it's all there.
Yeah.
When you read it out loud, you go, where's that gone? Well, it's such a great editing technique. And it's very, very different, I think, writing and speaking and reading. It's crazy how separate it all is.
Particularly for dialogue.
Yeah.
I had a question following from that. A lot of books now go into audiobooks. Does that influence your writing at all, and how that book will sound as an audio?
I'm actually writing, and Shankari has just put out an Audible original book called Unfinished Business, so she wrote it as audio first, and I'm doing the same thing. And definitely thinking about clarity in terms of making sure everything comes across very clearly, because when you're on the page, and I'm a huge fan of audiobooks, I've been listening to them since they were on tape, there is something about when you're on the page, you can just skim your eyes back up and check in detail. In audio, you have to make sure you're coming across really, really clearly to the reader.
It's not something I think about in the writing, but one thing I learned, my first book went to audiobook, and it's history, but I'm sort of in it, and it's immersive, and I'm in it. And I had to choose the voice actor, and I chose this guy who used to be on Downton Abbey. And I thought, that's great, he sounds great. But then when he's reading things that I would say in Australian vernacular, it just doesn't make any sense. So I'll be more careful who I choose to read rather than the writing. Yeah.
How many more questions?
I can be here all day. This is up to Victoria.
I'll take one more question, if that's okay. Just on aware of time, because I know we can chat forever, right? And then we've obviously got some books, and we'd love you to sign some books as well. So where's next to the last part? There we go.
A book is a work of art. And why is it so important that it's marketable?
Because we need money to live.
No, sorry. But you could change 100 lives with the book that you wanted to write. But you can amuse a couple of thousand with a book that you really weren't happy with. What's the best thing to do?
Oh, well, so you write a book that you're happy with, that you think readers will love, but you then put into it something that you believe is really, really important. So, like, my dark mode deals with men's rights activists and misogyny. I was very proud of myself when I was accused of hating men after that book came out, which, for the record, I don't. So you put into the book what matters. But I think the thing about being marketable is, like, we all have, I think all of us have books that are in drawers that, like, no one will read. And I think that's the difference. It's like, if zero people read it, it doesn't matter how meaningful it is. There's so many books on the shelves that just are not getting read, right? So if you want your message to reach people, then you need to engage in the idea of marketability.
Any thoughts?
No, I think that's perfect.
I think you summed it
up.
Yeah. I'll
that's
disagree.
Right.
I've been reading this Spanish writer lately, Javier Cercas, and he's gone through his own sort of journey of writing from entertainment to art, and he says something that entertainment is the enemy of art. And I think if you've got a privilege to be published, and we've all had that privilege here, I think there's a responsibility, and I think the more important thing is for me is the art. Not that I've done that, but I'm thinking that lately. I would say it's more important to change the life of 100 people than entertain 1,000. I think we've got plenty of ways to entertain ourselves, but to actually make change, and when you meet someone who's been changed by reading your book, I think to me that trumps selling 1,000 copies or...
Look, I
change the life of 1,000!
Yeah.
Right?
You're sitting on the fence, Tom style. It was an either or. If I'm going to choose, I'd love to write something that entertains everyone and changes people's lives. That's great. But if it's an either or, I'd rather change the lives.
Yeah, and I think on that, perhaps more aligned to Ashley, is that, and I don't presume that people's lives have been changed by my book, by Chai Thomas and Gardens. Thank you. But if not for the fact that Chai Thomas and Gardens sold effectively, for example, I would not have been able to then have Song of the Sun God published in Australia. And that was the book that I really wanted everyone to read. And so I needed to sell 1,000 books in order for that one book to come home.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Look, I think a lot of it's really been said, but I would say, as a writer, you write the book you really want to write. So that's your art, because it's what you really, really want to do. I think where I sit on this is that I really, really want people to read my books as well, so I feel I have to find a way to connect with them in a way that's going to make them not just turn the first page, but turn the 382nd page. You know, so yeah, there's a, I do think there's a happy medium. I don't know that it's an either or thing for me.
Oh, I will say it is either or.
No.
But he was asking if it was either or.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If I had a choice,
yeah,
if I have to choose.
I just want to say a huge thank you. Thank you so much for sharing all of the knowledge and all these tips. It's been a brilliant event. So give a huge round of applause.
Thank you.